challenges. And then we close our consulate in Basra. There have been reports on a plan to draw down substantially the American presence in the embassy to cut the staff. That would hardly be interpreted as, again, standing up to Iran. So the administration needs to figure out what it's going to do long term and then make that clear to the American people, to the Iranians, and to others in the region. I hope they do have a long-term plan, and it is based on a long-term commitment to our own interests in Iraq.
If you were called upon to give advice on what to do over the long term to bring more stability to this situation, what would you advise?
To make it clear that we do have long-term interests in Iraqi stability, that we will stand up for our security interests against immediate challenges, as we did with Islamic State, but that because it is over the long term, we are engaged there and we will remain engaged.
Yesterday, this group, Kateb Hezbollah, apparently issued a statement saying their next step after the embassy is to pass a law in the Iraqi parliament to legislate that the United States get out of Iraq. Now, I found that really interesting because it sounds like a peaceful step. What do you think?
Clearly, actions in parliament are preferable to actions on the ground. The fact that we're now seeing Kataib Hezbollah and supporters camped outside the walls, well, that's a lot better than having them inside the walls of Iraq. At the same time, Kataib Hezbollah and its Iranian overlords are certainly aware that in 2014, as Islamic State surged through northern and western Iraq, the last thing the Iraqi people and indeed the Iraqi government wanted was for the U.S. to get out. They wanted the U.S. to come back. I think we'll probably see some kind of drama in the parliament. Clearly, though, it would not be in the interests, I think, of the parliament or any aspect of the government of Iraq to have the U.S. pull out.
Very briefly, is it practical to get Iran to negotiate a new nuclear deal, which is the stated U.S. goal?
Well, not under current circumstances.
Okay, not going to happen the way things are. Former U.S. Ambassador to Iraq, Ryan Crocker, sir, thank you so much.
Thank you.
On this New Year's Day, Vladimir Putin marks 20 years as the leader of Russia, sometimes as president, sometimes as prime minister, in power the whole time. He took power amidst the poverty, crime, and chaos that followed the collapse of the Soviet Union. He prides himself on Russia's return to stability. But these days, a new generation of Russians who grew up under Putin is not so interested in how people lived before they were born. They measure themselves by their peers in Europe or the United States, and they don't like what they see. A recent poll shows more than half of these young Russians would like to leave their country. Young people are starting to rebel against Putin's rule, even in Russia's conservative heartland. Here's NPR's Lucian Kim.
Dmitry Nikolaev didn't used to care about politics. He was just a normal 20-something from Tula, an arms-producing town south of Moscow. His dad was a factory worker, his mom a saleswoman in a store. Then, out of the blue, he says, he was called in by the police. He posted on social media about a heavy metal band whose songs the government had labeled extremist. At that moment, Nikolaev says, I understood that something was wrong with my country. And he joined the political opposition to Vladimir Putin. In conservative Tula, though, most older people support the president. A generational divide found across the country. Just off a new pedestrian street in the historic town center, I meet Yulia Savelyeva, a 46-year-old engineer in one of the town's factories. She says Putin gave the weapons factories new business. When I ask her about a wave of anti-government protests in Moscow this summer, Savelyeva shrugs. I'm not very interested in politics, she says. I'm perfectly happy with the way things are. That kind of thinking infuriates Dmitry Nikolaev, the young man who joined the opposition. He supports Alexei Navalny, Russia's most famous anti-corruption campaigner who tried to run against Putin 2 years ago before he was banned from the election. I ran Navalny's Tula headquarters, Nikolaev says. Navalny, almost 25 years younger than Putin, was there to open the campaign office. Putin, of course, was re-elected. The Navalny campaign office has been shuttered. And Nikolaev's closest aide, Philip Simkins, has fled the country. I visit Simkins' mother, her name is Yelena Agayeva, in a grim Tula suburb. She says her son Philip just packed his bags one day last year and left, saying he could no longer live in Russia. He flew to Switzerland and now has political asylum. Agayeva says her son's political activism caused him to be kicked out of the vocational school where he was studying to be a train engineer. He'd already been locked up a week for organizing a rally and was threatened with more jail time if he continued.
He thought that if we all stand up against Putin and corruption, everything would change. But he didn't change Russia. The government changed his life.
All that Philippe left behind is a computer, a mountain bike, and his cat. Agayeva switches on the computer and plays a song he used to sing. The name of the song is I'll Be Back, and it's by a singer who grew up in the same gritty Tula suburb as Philippe. I ask Agayeva if she thinks her son will also return. No, he's not coming back, she says, and I don't want him to. He's safer where he is now. Lucien Kim, NPR News, Tula.
On this New Year's Day, we are looking back 20 years to the turn of the millennium.
From National Public Radio, this is Weekend Edition. Welcome to a new century. There were virtually no Y2K-related computer problems to report. Now, there is still a chance that some problems will develop in the weeks and months to come.
That was our colleague Scott Simon talking about Y2K.
Which was the concern that computer systems would fail to cope with the change in date from 1999 to 2000 and would malfunction, leading to a global crisis. Americans at the time had been told to worry. Worry a lot. And here on NPR News, we prepared for everything.
We'll talk about Y2K nerves. What's your definition of vigilance? Do you feel prepared? We're taking your Y2K calls on Talk of the Nation.
What's most worrisome, though, is that one out of three schools has no contingency plans.
There are a growing number of doomsday or millennial groups who regard the coming of the year 2000 as a profound event.
Here at the Y2K Command Center, things have been quiet all day. Very quiet, actually. The new millennium has now dawned across much of the world, with few reports of problems due to Y2K computer glitches.
It was inescapable.
That last voice was Andrea Tapia. She studies technology and risk at Penn State University. But back then, she was a grad student writing her dissertation about Y2K. And her colleagues would ask her,
how scary is this? Should I actually go out and buy water and food?
Nah, some groups were hunkering down or arming themselves for chaos. But Tapia was relatively unconcerned. She did say that Y2K was a real problem.
Computer professionals across many, many, many industries and disciplines and across national boundaries came together over a few years to solve a problem globally, and nobody noticed. If they had not solved it, there would have been major technological disasters.
Like government records could have been lost, medical records, power plants could have gone offline.
None of that happened, but there's still time for some other bit of chaos, because experts say another debacle like Y2K could happen again.
2038.
That's because of a computer formatting issue, but Tapia says don't worry so much about that. Computer professionals are already preparing, and they've got a few years. Happy New Year. It's NPR News.
Good morning. This is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Hannah Haynes. Later this hour, we'll be bringing you Wisconsin Life. Today, a story of a taxidermist in the state. Amanda Bestuhl is one of only a few women running one of these businesses in Wisconsin, and we'll hear from her in about 25 minutes.
As a donor to Wisconsin Public Radio, you're part of an amazing group of 54,000 members who share your appreciation of unbiased news, important discussions, and high-quality entertainment. The variety of programs, the information on WPR.org, events in your community, e-newsletters, and so much more, it's all possible thanks to your support. Thank you for making a difference in Wisconsin.
Support for WPR comes from David Sedaris on Tour. coming to Overture Center in Madison on April 27th and Riverside Theater in Milwaukee on April 28th. Tickets and information at davidsedarisontour.com.
There are moments in life where we all must rise, where we all must answer the call. Join me, Austin Brandt.
And me, Tim Williamson.
On a new podcast from WGTD and Gateway,
where we highlight the tremendous sacrifices of emergency medical personnel. Subscribe to The Call, now on Apple and Google Podcasts.
In the weather forecast, mostly sunny skies today, afternoon highs reaching the upper 30s. It'll be windy and temperatures dropping into the 20s this evening. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy skies to start the day, clearing as the day goes on. Afternoon highs in the upper 30s in the north and the mid 40s in the south. And then rain or snow, depending on where you are in the state, moving into the state on Thursday night into Friday morning.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, committed to bridging science and the arts to develop a common language so that they can better understand and speak to one another. More information is at sloan.org. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, working with states to develop data-driven, nonpartisan solutions for complex issues. More information is available at pewtrusts.org. From the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just society. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noel King.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. California's Consumer Privacy Act goes into effect today, New Year's Day. It is supposed to give consumers the power to prevent retailers and other companies from selling their personal data. You can opt out. No matter where you live, California's law may affect you. Stuart Brotman of the Wilson Center, which is a think tank here in Washington, specializes in digital privacy policy issues.
This is a pretty dramatic new law. As you know, California is the fifth largest economy by GDP in the world. So even though it's one state, it affects a large part of the United States and even parts of the world.
Is it even more influential because so many tech companies are headquartered inside California?
Yes, I think so, because any company that essentially touches a California resident will be affected by this law. That includes companies that are in California and companies outside California that are serving people who live there.
What is California making tech companies do that some or all of them were not doing before?
Well, it's not just tech companies. It's basically any company that collects information about people. And that's virtually any company that does so. So it's not just the Googles and the Facebooks of the world. It's every company. It's your auto body shop. It's your bank. It's a variety of different institutions. And so that's why it has such a broad reach.
What things have to happen then for those various kinds of retailers and service firms and so forth?
Well, one of the magic things you're going to see is there's going to be a button when you go on a website of a company that's covered by this act. And there's going to be a magic button that says, do not collect or do not sell my information.
Hmm.
And you can literally press that button, and that essentially gives notice that whoever is collecting that information has to segregate that information and not sell it to anyone.
Is this a good way to legislate what is effectively a nationwide or even global rule?
Well, this is a major controversy whether or not this is something that should be done by the states or the federal government. Right now, there are only two states, California and Maine, which have enacted laws, but there are a variety of other states, including New York and Pennsylvania, which are looking at state legislation. On the other hand, you have Congress, which says, wait a second, this should not be done by the states. We should have one standard, just like Europe has one standard for the entire European Union.
Are there companies, institutions, entities that do not have to comply with these rules?
Yes, and this is the big exception here. Government does not need to comply. And as you know, government is a major collector of information, often often you don't have an option whether or not you want to give up that information. A good example might be a Department of Motor Vehicles. If you want to get a license or a car registration, you have to give up that information.
Someone listening is finding it ironic that the very state that legislated this is not complying with it itself.
Yes, and that is a great irony, and obviously it's going to create a lot of practical problems. In California right now, the Department of Motor Vehicles, in fact, doesn't tell consumers that their information is being sold to third parties, and those third parties are commercial entities, so they'll sell it to a credit bureau or they'll sell it to a data broker.
What is the justification for that?
Well, money. They're getting about $50 million a year, and obviously they need more money, so they figured out there are other ways to do that.
Some people will know that the New York Times recently reported a large project in which they revealed how easy it is to track people's movements using location tracking data. Is that covered by the new California
law? No, it is not. And in fact, there's going to be a new ballot initiative in November 2020, which will essentially strengthen parts of this California Consumer Privacy Act. And one of the other big loopholes here is that it doesn't cover geolocation tracking, which is the ability to track where you are and store that information.
The ballot initiative would close that loophole as far as tracking people's locations?
Yes, it would. But it would only apply to businesses, not necessarily governments.
Is this ultimately a losing battle? We have to share so much information with so many companies in order to do normal business with them anymore that there's very little that people can truly, truly do about it.
No, I don't think it's a losing battle, but I don't think we necessarily can come in and say we have a one-size-fits-all solution, which is going to apply to all circumstances and all technologies.
Stuart Brotman, thanks so much.
Thank you. Great to be here.
If astronauts are going to walk on Mars someday, they will, of course, need to breathe. So they'll either need to bring oxygen or make it there. On NASA's next robotic mission, they plan to bring an instrument that can do that, that can make oxygen. Here's NPR's Joe Palca.
There's an obvious reason you need oxygen once you get to Mars.
You need oxygen to breathe.
Jeff Hoffman is a former astronaut, now on the engineering faculty at MIT. There's very little atmosphere on Mars to begin with, and only a tiny amount of that is oxygen. But what atmosphere there is mostly carbon dioxide, and it's possible to make oxygen by chemically separating it from the carbon dioxide, CO2. Hoffman says that would be a good thing.
If I were on the surface of Mars, I would be very happy to have a source of oxygen that I could breathe.
But a human only needs about 2 pounds of oxygen a day. Hoffman says a bigger oxygen need will be for the propellant for a rocket to bring you home.
To get off the surface of Mars, you need a lot of propellant.
Tens of tons of propellant. And a lot of that propellant will need to be liquid oxygen. You could ship the oxygen from Earth, but that would be super expensive and highly inefficient.
Anything that you can make on Mars is going to reduce the cost and complexity of getting there and surviving there considerably.
Hoffman and his colleagues have built an instrument called MOXIE that will go to Mars in a mission later this year. He says the instrument separates oxygen from CO2, and it works great here on Earth.
But if you're ever going to rely on a process or a piece of hardware that's really critical for a space mission, and, you know, if you're counting on this to produce oxygen to get home, I would call that critical. You've got to demonstrate that it works not just in the laboratory on Earth, but in the actual environment. And that's why we're sending MOXIE to Mars.
Hoffman says MOXIE isn't going to produce much oxygen.
Anywhere from roughly 6 to 10 grams of oxygen per hour.
That's less than half an ounce. But if MOXIE works as advertised, it could be scaled up. And who knows, maybe MOXIE 5.0 or MOXIE 10.0 will be able to produce enough oxygen for rocket fuel to bring astronauts home. Joe Palca, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Sports journalism is more than just keeping score. Over the years, coverage has shifted from debates over whether college athletes should be paid to other issues like the excessive power of college athletic departments.
That revenue ultimately goes to pay for salaries for an executive class of athletic administrator and coach.
How one journalist has embraced the shift. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.
It's Morning Edition on WPR. Coming up in the newscast, there's a group in La Crosse that wants to help voters make more informed decisions in the coming year. We'll learn more about the work they're doing, plus more Wisconsin news, all coming up after this news update from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Hundreds of U.S. troops from the 82nd Airborne Division at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, are heading to the Middle East. The deployment is in response to yesterday's attack on the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad. Jay Price of member station WUNC reports.
The 82nd keeps several thousand troops in a constant state of readiness so they can be in the air and headed to a trouble spot hours after getting their orders. It's unclear how many will ultimately be sent, but more are prepared to deploy over the next few days, according to a statement from Secretary of Defense Mark Esper. For NPR News, I'm Jay Price in Fayetteville, North Carolina.
Protesters gathered again today at the embassy. They were dispersed by security forces firing tear gas. The protesters are angry about Sunday's deadly U.S. airstrikes on Iran-backed militia positions. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has declared his country is abandoning its moratorium on nuclear and long-range missile tests. The BBC's Viv Marsh has more.
In his reported comments, Mr. Kim complained of U.S. belligerence and accused Washington of gangster-like demands. But he left room for dialogue, saying Pyongyang's nuclear development plans would depend on the Americans' future attitude. In response, the U.S. Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, said he hoped North Korea would choose peace and prosperity over war.
The BBC's Viv Marsh. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Hannah Haynes. A nonpartisan group in La Crosse hopes to help voters elect ethical political leaders in the next election through a new 2020 Citizens Guide. Hope Kerwin has more.
Leader Ethics Wisconsin is a nonprofit group working to promote ethical leadership among elected officials. Lee Rush is the group's founder and executive director. He says in fields like business, education, or healthcare, people expect leaders to be transparent and unifying.
That's true in all those other occupations except the political arena. And so we have to get people to think that why would we accept that? And why can't we raise that bar?
Rush says Leader Ethics wants to empower the average citizen to ask candidates about ethics ahead of the 2020 election and to spot misleading information online. He says the group is focusing their efforts on local races and has already contacted state lawmakers about the effort. Hope Kerwin, Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Wisconsin Badgers will face the Oregon Ducks today in the Rose Bowl. Wisconsin has won five straight bowl games. That's the longest streak in Big Ten history. The Badgers will look to extend that record tonight. WPR's Megan Hart is in Pasadena.
The Badgers are three-point favorites over the Ducks. The teams last faced each other in the 2012 Rose Bowl. Oregon won it. Wisconsin and Oregon are both physical teams. Badgers quarterback Jack Cohn says it should be a good matchup.
Yeah, obviously they're an amazing defense. We've got a lot of great players all over the field, so it's going to be a tough game.
This is Wisconsin's fourth trip to Pasadena in the last 10 years. The Badgers won back-to-back Rose Bowls in 1999 and 2000. Cohn says this year's team hopes to leave its mark on Wisconsin Rose Bowl history.
I feel good. I'm just really excited. You know, this game has a lot of history behind it, especially for Wisconsin. So to be a part of the history will be pretty cool.
The game kicks off at 4 p.m. In Pasadena, Megan Hart, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Retailers legally selling marijuana for the past month in Michigan say they have drawn customers from surrounding Midwestern states like Wisconsin, where the drug remains illegal. And beginning today, recreational marijuana becomes legal in Illinois. Wisconsin residents can purchase it in Illinois, but it cannot be brought into the state legally. In Michigan, $4.7 million of recreational marijuana was sold in the first 3 weeks of December. Regulators don't know how much of that was bought by out-of-state customers. This is news from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Procter & Gamble, maker of Align, a daily probiotic supplement containing a gastroenterologist-developed strain to support digestive health. Learn more at AlignProbiotics.com. And from iDrive, maker of Remote PC,
providing remote access to computers anywhere, for remote assistance and featuring remote PC vision, an augmented reality support tool. Learn more at remotepc.com.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noel King.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. 2 years of diplomacy between the presidents of the U.S. and North Korea produced one large substantive success from the U.S. point of view during the period that President Trump has been meeting, exchanging letters with, and constantly flattering Kim Jong-un. North Korea has kept a promise not to test nuclear weapons or long-range missiles. Now, Kim says, that's over. In a speech to the ruling Workers' Party Central Committee, Kim says North Korea no longer feels bound by that promise. He is disappointed that talks produced no long-term agreement with the U.S. NPR's Anthony Kuhn has been following this story for years. He joins us from Seoul. Hey there, Anthony.
Hey, Steve.
And Happy New Year. What does Kim say his country's going to do now?
Well, in his typical dramatic fashion, he said that the North will take shocking action and will introduce a new strategic weapon soon, which he did not identify. But it was very clear that he was not breaking off negotiations with the U.S. Hmm. Now, let's hear what North Korean people heard from their state television broadcaster. 이러한 조건에서 지켜주는 대방도 없는 공약에 우리가 더 이상. Okay, so in that clip, a TV anchor is quoting Kim as saying that North Korea instituted this moratorium on nuclear and missile testing unilaterally over the past 2 years. The U.S. did not respond positively. Instead, it kept on having military drills with South Korea, shipping them advanced weapons, and so there's really no point in North Korea sticking unilaterally to that commitment any longer. And Kim said that the U.S. was chilling North Korean efforts for worldwide nuclear disarmament, not stopping, but chilling. He also didn't say they were going to resume testing right away. He said on several occasions they're going to attempt a frontal breakthrough. In other words, defeat U.S. attempts to isolate them and sanction them into submission. And he said that the U.S. is basically now just stalling on negotiations while keeping hostile policies in place.
You know, it sounds like Kim could have done a lot more than he did. There were a lot of people in the U.S. expecting an actual missile test, for example. That hasn't happened yet, but this is a change from what he's been saying, right?
It's a change. I really don't think it's a break from last year's policies. He had been building up with all these political theatrics, riding white horses and holding these long party meetings, suggesting that he was coming to a critical juncture where he was going to make a strategic choice. Clearly, we're going to see a more hardline policy in the next year, but he's also leaving the door open for concessions by the U.S., I think.
How is the U.S. responding?
Well, President Trump said to reporters at a New Year's Eve party that he thinks Kim is still a man of his word. Let's hear what he said.
He did sign an agreement talking about denuclearization, and that was signed, number one sentence, denuclearization. That was done in Singapore, and I think he's a man of his word, so we're going to find out, but I think he's a man of his word.
Now, of course, the declaration that Trump and Kim signed in Singapore did talk about working towards denuclearization, but said nothing about what that actually means, how they're going to do it, or when. Pyongyang now insists that the ball is in Washington's court. Hence, you know, what they get as their Christmas present depends on their attitude. Hmm. They say that Washington has presented the North with proposals for moving ahead, but they haven't made any of those public.
Anthony, thanks so much.
You bet, Steve.
That's NPR's Anthony Kuhn reporting today from Seoul.
In France, a strike over proposed changes to government pensions is now on day 28. In his New Year's Eve address, President Emmanuel Macron says the government isn't planning to back down. Here's NPR's Eleanor Beardsley.
Charles de Gaulle gave the first New Year's Eve address in 1960. Since then, presidents have used it to speak of the nation's values or bring people together in times of difficulty.
Française, Français.
Last night, Macron touted the economic reforms he's carried out since taking office and laid out a sweeping vision for France for the next decade. He said the French people had always come together in solidarity, like when Notre Dame caught fire. They would do so again, he said.
Je mesure aussi combien les décisions prises peuvent parfois heurter
I know that some are afraid of changes, but is this a reason to abandon what we've started? No, because it's our children who will pay the price. This is why I will complete this reform of our pension system. It is a project of justice and social progress. It ensures that our system is more equal and universal.
But the unions say Macron's plan will penalize those with physically demanding jobs by making them work longer. Macron wants to raise the minimum retirement age from 62 to 64. This morning, Philippe Martinez, head of the hardline CGT union, called on the French to strike and protest even harder.
Faced with a president who does such an exercise in self-satisfaction and who considers that everything is going well in this country, we need to sound the alarm even louder because he obviously hasn't understood that there is a problem.
But it's not just hardliners who are against Macron's plans. The latest poll shows 51% of the French public support the strikers. At this New Year's Eve dinner, everyone gathered to watch Macron's speech. No one here understands the pension overhaul. Retired schoolteacher Françoise Lefebvre believes it will force people to work longer for less, and she wants the strikers to continue.
Teachers will lose a lot of money when they will be retired, so they have to be strong together.
But retired airline steward Philippe Gibert thinks Macron is doing a good job with the pension reform and when he overhauled the French labor market last year to make France more competitive. Gibert says Macron has an image problem because people think he's arrogant and a president of the rich.
I think people don't like him mainly because he began his presidency with measures for people who have money. And this was very bad for his image. And after that, he tries to change things, but people don't accept that because they believe he works for people with money.
Unions say they will continue the transport strike that has hobbled commuter trains and paralyzed the Paris metro system. They're also threatening to block oil refineries and bring the country to a standstill, sending an even tougher message to Macron. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. It's 8:42 right now, and there's just a bit more Morning Edition today before we transition over to Morning Classics with your host, Stephanie Elkins. But still to come, we've got Wisconsin Life for You coming up in just a moment. Stick around for that. But if you can't stick around or you want to listen to even more Wisconsin Life, you can find episodes old and new by subscribing to our podcast. Find that wherever you get your podcasts and never miss an episode.
What have you always wondered about Wisconsin, its people, or its culture?
What's the history of Sunday hot ham and rolls?
What are the predicted consequences of climate change for the different parts of Wisconsin?
How did the Wisconsin Dells become the Wisconsin Dells?
With Wisconsin, you ask the questions and we answer them. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin-Madison, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association.
Support comes from Sweet Impact Chocolates, an eco-friendly producer of handmade truffles and caramels, where 10% of sales are donated to organizations helping disadvantaged women and children. Shop locally or online. SweetImpactChocolates.com.
Here's what the weather looks like over the next few days. Today, mostly sunny skies, afternoon highs reaching the upper 30s, temperatures dropping into the 20s this evening. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy skies to start the day. It'll clear as the day goes on, afternoon highs in the upper 30s in the north and the mid-40s in the south, and then rain or snow moving into the state at night on Thursday and then into Friday morning and lasting until Friday afternoon. Potential snow accumulation of up to 3 inches is possible.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Heather Sturt Haga and Paul G. Haga, supporting African Wildlife Foundation, working to ensure the future of Africa's wildlife and wild lands. Learn more at awf.org. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. And from the William T. Grant Foundation at WTGrantFoundation.org.
Good morning. It's 8:45 now, and it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a taxidermist.
Wisconsin's hunting season is underway. After the meat has been packed up in the freezer, taxidermists often take on the job of mounting the heads of the harvest. Amanda Bestuel of Iola is relatively new to the business and one of the few independently operating female taxidermists in the state. She told WPR's Patty Murray that mounting deer and other animals after they've been harvested is a respectful thing to do. Plus, it's part of some Wisconsinites' heritage.
Oh, hey. Hi, Amanda.
Amanda Bestuel greets me at her front door and leads me down to her basement workshop, which is well-ventilated and equipped with freezers.
I got into taxidermy basically because I've always had an interest in animals, and I was a fan of taxidermy. I enjoyed looking at it. And when I moved up here, I married into a hunting family.
Do you think you would have been into this business otherwise?
That's a good question, and not one I've really thought about because this is where my life has brought me, but I think one way or another I would have gotten into taxidermy, mainly because it was always in the back of my mind, but there was a little bit of women don't do that, and I think that kind of squashed the idea for a long time. Until I grew up and got the confidence to just do it.
Bestuel tans the hides of the animals, mostly deer. She has done everything from turkeys to a black squirrel and black bears.
To date, I would say my most challenging mount, I did a three-quarter bear, and it was most challenging because of its size and my size. It was a bit of a wrestle getting the hide onto the form.
Is there any animal you'd like to do you haven't done yet?
Gosh, there's so many I'd like to do. The next project I'm really excited about is to do my first bobcat, which I have in the freezer. It's ready to go tanned. I just need to put it on the form in this freezer in here.
Bestuel finds the cat's hide and pulls it out of her freezer that looks like it could be in any suburban basement.
You know what? The bobcat's right here.
Instead of a frozen pizza or chicken nuggets, she pulls out a bobcat pelt. Bestuel and other taxidermists generally tan the hides of animals, then put them on a type of sculpted form similar to styrofoam. They add glass eyes to make the specimens look alive.
This was actually a roadkill bobcat that a customer picked up, and it was in good shape. That's another way to get specimens for taxidermy.
Festal feels she's honoring the animals that have been killed. She also says most customers eat the meat.
Rarely do I buy any meat from the store that's been, you know, produced from factory farms and all that. It's, you know where your food's coming from, and I think that's important to a lot of people.
That story about taxidermist Amanda Bestuel of Iola came to us from WPR's Patty Murray. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every single Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast feed and find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on all the social media. Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is WPR.
Support comes from Piasecki Funeral Home. Why not give the gift of peace of mind? Pre-plan your funeral arrangements with their caring, compassionate staff. They are dedicated to you, your family, and guests. 262-658-4101, KenoshaFuneralHome.com.
Concert setting. WPR is pleased to support classical music in our communities. For more information, go to WPR.org/events.
In sports, the Milwaukee Bucks play the Minnesota Timberwolves tonight at 7, and the Badgers play in the Rose Bowl tonight. They face the Oregon Ducks, and game time is 4 o'clock.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noel King.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Almost any great writer needs a great editor, a champion who understands their work and makes it better. The editor of many a great writer has died. Sonny Mehta was 77, the editor-in-chief of the publishing house Alfred A. Knopf, where his authors included Toni Morrison, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, and John Le Carré. NPR's Rose Friedman has this appreciation.
Sonny Mehta didn't like to talk about himself. In fact, in NPR's archive, the longest clip I could find of him was one in which he quoted two other people on the definition of a classic.
I think it was Mark Twain who described it as a book which people praise and don't read. But the one I feel closest to is Clifton Fadiman's, and he said, when you read a classic, you do not see more in the book than you did before. You see more in you than there was before.
He was, on occasion, brilliantly articulate, but he largely left the articulation to his authors.
James Elroy was one of those authors. He says Mehta's strength was that he didn't just acquire books, he reveled in hammering out the details with authors.
Sonny got in there with me for years, and I write the most complex crime books ever written. And he could talk plot points with me, chapter and verse, on and on and on.
When Mehta published Elroy's novel, White Jazz, the author says they discussed the syncopated style down to each sentence.
I could pluck White Jazz off my shelf right now and go, Sonny, me, Sonny, me.
Sonny Mehta was born in New Delhi in 1942. He was the son of a diplomat and moved around the world frequently. His career in publishing began in London, but it was in New York that he became something of a legend. He published 6 Nobel Prize winners, celebrities, Pope John Paul II, thrillers by John Le Carré, and such literary authors as Jhumpa Lahiri, Joan Didion, and Patti Smith. Mehta lived through huge changes in publishing, the rise of ebooks and Amazon, but author Robert Caro, a historian whose books about power and the ways it's wielded take famously long to write, says Mehta always gave him the room he needed.
Never once did he ask me when I would deliver the manuscript, when I would be finished.
he really understood what I was trying to achieve with my books. And he gave me the thing I needed most, time, to try to achieve them the best I could.
Sunny Mehta never stopped working, and James Ellroy says he never stopped looking for the next great book.
He had a truffle-sniffing bloodhound's instinct for books at all points in the development of a manuscript. His bloodhound snout was right down there on the page.
Sunny Mehta, who loved a cigarette and a scotch and the opera and a good book, best of all. Rose Friedman, NPR News, New York.
As the clock hit midnight and we started a new decade, people across the world heard Auld Lang Syne. It was written in 1788 by Robert Burns, who's the national poet of Scotland. NPR's Joanna Kakissis went to the Scottish town of Inverness, and she found that with Brexit approaching, people are in their feelings about the song.
It was cold on the banks of the River Ness, but thousands of Scots huddled together to celebrate Hogmanay, the last day of the year, and to toast the year ahead.
New Year, I mean, if you ask me, it's more important than Christmas.
I really, you know, feel very excited about this new year.
It's the end of bad things happening and a good start, moving to good new things.
That was farmer Lachlan Jardine, neurosurgeon Anjali Gombain, and police officer Lynn Falconer. Retiree Catherine Falconer joined her daughter Lynn to sing a song known all over the world.
Although lots of people try to claim it as their own, it's a Scottish song.
When Robert Burns first wrote Auld Lang Syne, it didn't sound the way we know it now. Ian Gordon, president of the Burns Club in Inverness, sings what's believed to be the original version.
Should all the acquaintance be forgot and never...
But the lyrics are the same. Kirstine McHugh knows them all.
We twa here in about the braes and pooed the gowans fine, but we've wandered many a weary fit in Auld Lang Syne.
Rabbi Burns, as the poet isn't known by the Scots, is her specialty.
I'm Professor of Scottish Literature and Song Culture at the University of Glasgow, where I'm also co-director of the Centre for Robert Burns Studies.
McHugh has loved Burns since she was a teenager in the Scottish countryside. Her favourite lines are in the middle of the song.
We twa, he paddled in the burn, frae morning sun till dine. But seas between us braid, he roared, sin Auld Lang Syne.
She translates from the Scots language into English.
You know, as children, we played around in the river and we caught fishies and we've pulled the wild flowers and the daisies on the hillsides. But in fact, broad seas have roared between us.
Burns wrote Auld Lang Syne during a tumultuous time.
There were two major revolutions in America and in France. The British were fighting in many European wars. It was also a time when Scots began to emigrate from areas of the Highlands and moving around the country from rural areas to urban areas. Time of great upheaval, great turmoil. My goodness, there are many resonances with the world we live in the 21st century.
Particularly so as the UK prepares to leave the European Union. Brexit has also renewed talk of Scotland leaving the United Kingdom, which Inverness teacher Duncan Dyker supports. He says Burns would have too.
If he'd been alive today, he would have been a nationalist.
Really?
I think so.
But retiree Gwen MacLeod believes Burns would not have wanted Scotland to face the world alone.
The more friends we have now, the better.
Isn't that what the song's about?
That's what the song's about.
It's actually hard to know which way Scotland's great bard would have swung on this issue. Kirstine McHugh, the Burns scholar, describes him as very cautious with politics.
Burns himself is a bit of a chameleon. So you see him writing ardently anti-English poetry. You see him writing unionist British poetry or song. You will see him write from every perspective because he had an amazing ability to be people on all sides of the divide.
And that's why everyone sings his famous song. Those who romanticize the past and those who yearn for the future. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, Inverness, Scotland.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noel King.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Hannah Haynes. You can hear Morning Edition weekdays from 5 to 9 here on WPR. And join us this afternoon for BBC NewsHour beginning at 3, followed by All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30. It's a minute before 9 o'clock right now, and stay with us. Morning Classics is just ahead.
Support for WPR comes from 4imprint, providers of promotional products for businesses, including embroidered apparel, trade show giveaways, and logoed business gifts. More about 4imprint's dedication to customer satisfaction is at 4imprint.com.
There are moments in life where we all must rise, where we all must answer the call. Join me, Austin Brandt.
And me, Tim Williamson.
On a new podcast from WGTD and Gateway.
Where we highlight the tremendous sacrifices of emergency medical personnel. Subscribe to The Call, now on Apple and Google Podcasts.
You're listening to WGTD HD.